Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Ma'am Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. And as always, we have our day in and Selma. I think Selma is the appropriate place because I believe if we were to build a metaphysics or a historical timeline, Selma, Alabama was the last bastion of white supremacy for us to enter into America. We are now in America. Whether we like it or not, we are in America. We can keep beating this country down. We're here. We have voting rights. It's up to us to exercise. Are there some glitches? Absolutely. Do we have the right to live anywhere in America? Yes. Do we have the right to be citizens of America? After all the rights that everybody else has in America. So all those barriers are broken down. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But nobody promised us a rose garden. But God did promise us a garden upon which four rivers flow. So we've gained that. So all we got to do is go to work. Dear beloved people, I'm going to start quickly with the answers we have been raising and asking about our state. And some of you might know I am very militant and forcing African Americans to take on their full responsibility and right. The city of Chicago is a city that has spawned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad, and one of the greatest political figures known to man, and one of the greatest figures in religion after the Prophet Muhammad himself. But yet that city has not been able to withstand a debtor. Yet that city has not been able to withstand on Memorial Day weekend 40 shootings. And I must warn you that these shootings didn't come from the Ku Klux Klan. It came from the KKK, Ken Killing Ken. I don't think it would be anything but appropriate to ask a prosecutor that deals with the law, prosecuting criminals, a legal scholar who deals with legal procedures, criminal procedures, civil rights, taught from the great courts, textbook of the great A. Leon Hickenbottom. However, he's something even greater than he's a practitioner of scripture, Quran, Bible. With all these bodies of knowledge, combining with the insights he had gained from Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad, what do you make of Memorial Day weekend in Chicago? Chirac, as Mr. Spike Lee would put it.
Brother Imam, let me say, I can barely hear you. Are we having technical difficulties, or is it something wrong with my receptor, my telephone?
I can barely hear you. Can you hear me now?
Still barely.
Let's see whether we can get you better and tell me how this is, otherwise we have to use another line. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you, but still not the forceful voice that I'm accustomed to in our interviews.
Stand by, and I'll try to use another line. Just a minute. Just stand by. Don't hang up. Don't go anyplace. Brother Imam, you can continue talking, and I'm going to use another mic to come back. Thank you. Start talking.
Let me say to you and to your audience, it's a pleasure to be here today. And before I answer the question that was posed, the query that was posed by Brother Imam, that was raised by him, let me just come at it from a recent situation that I had in Selma, Alabama. When I first came to Selma, I worked at Legal Services, and I got to meet a lot of everyday African Americans. I befriended one who took a liking to me, and I'm not going to call this person's name. Over the years, we would see each other, and we would speak and exchange words in a very kind, compassionate, and gracious manner. But over the years, we kind of lost contact. And one day, I got a call from this gentleman, and he was in a very upset state, to say the least, and that's an understatement. He told me he wanted to meet with me, and I met with him, and he told me about the situation of his grandson. I hadn't seen the grandfather lately, but he was a diabetic, and both of his legs had been severed as a result of his condition. So we talk, and he burst into tears. He said, "Salam," that's what he called me. So he got my grandson out there without any bond. I knew what he was talking about because in Dallas County there's a general rigid policy that if there is a charge where a weapon or a gun was involved, then the DA, law enforcement, and the local judge are normally going to set a high bond. And while he did not kill anybody, he was charged with shooting in an occupied dwelling, shooting in a vehicle, and all of that. So my first goal, I wanted to help my old friend, so I had to file a motion for the reduction of bond. And to make a long story short, we came from no bond to $25,000 bond. So my client was released. I got a chance to talk to him and his young girlfriend. And they were thinking about coming up to one of my community development classes. But it was not long after his release that some of his enemies in the African-American community came by and shot up the grandfather's place. One of the reasons why I was able to get the bond lowered was I made the argument before the judge that this young man services was critically needed at the home because he was the sole caretaker of his grandparents. The grandmother was in bad shape. But these opponents came by and just unloaded on the resident. The brother who didn't have any legs was almost killed. His wife had limited mobility. She hit the floor and couldn't crawl, couldn't move, and the young man was grazed in the side. The next day I went back to the DA. See, this is a state that we have, not only in Chicago, but in Selma, Alabama. Not a grand, ultra-sized, mega urban area, but Selma, Alabama. I'm going to answer your question, Brother Imam. But I had to go to the judge and the DA. I say, look.
You answered it, brother. Keep going.
You all going to have to come off some of the bond restrictions, because they wanted him to stay around Selma. I said, if he stays in town, He's liable to get murdered, and his grandmama and granddad and everybody else in the house. The judge and the DA agreed with me. So I got with the client and his significant other, his, which some would call girlfriend. I told him what the deal is. I say, look, don't you come back to Selma. I'm not going to have a preliminary hearing. I'm going to let this thing, I'm going to waive the case to the grand jury. And next time you're going to have to come to town, it's going to be trial. We're not going to even have an arraignment. I'm going to submit a waiver of arraignment. Get out of Selma and stay out of Selma. This is what I told him. After he went up there, he went to Huntsville, Alabama. And Huntsville has a very good economy. So he and his so-called girlfriend, I said so-called because she was a grown, fully embodied female. Tell you the truth, wasn't no girl about her, maybe emotionally to a certain extent and maybe some mental immaturity. But they got a job. Unbeknownst to me, this is what we got to understand. The prior state of African-American life. He had a job with making money, and some of his home folk that were living in Huntsville temporarily gave him his later place to stay. But they claim he stole some out the house. So they became angry, and they told him he had to go. I didn't know anything about any of this until later, after it was too late. And when they evicted him, he didn't call me. He came back to Selma. If he had called me, I would have told him don't come back to Selma under any circumstance. Go homeless up there in Huntsville if you have to. Stay in a cheap motel until you and your lady could get yourself straight. Because there's dangerous violence in Selma, Alabama right now. Murder after murder after murder. But he came back. Wasn't back but a few days. And some young opponents sneak him while he's sitting down in his car and put a bullet through his brains.
Wow.
I didn't know anything about it. My wife happened to be just looking at the Selma obituary, and she didn't know I was representing this person. She just said, hey, there's a 26-year-old man in this obituary that's dead. I said that they say the cause of death. Then she gave me his name. I said, that sounds like my client. So this was over Memorial Day weekend, so I had to wait until everything began to operate on Tuesday. And I checked into the matter, and the aunt of a co-defendant, there's another co-defendant that I got over in Georgia, told me, said, yes, Alon, that's him. A 21-year-old boy sneaked him and blew his brains out as he was sitting in a car. Now, this is Selma, Alabama. Without a whole lot of adverse karma, what do I mean by that? Detroit, Michigan, been halfway wiped out. Now you have a run of perpetual, chronic, and pathological violence coming out of the African-American community in Chicago. What do I mean by adverse karma? They violated the law of violated spiritual law, and now they are reaping the consequences. I know some in the audience may not agree with what I'm about to say, but we have to have the strength to put it out there. Because not only are we here in America, not only are we struggling in America, but we are prepared to lead America. Declining Bubba, rising Latinos, excelling aging Americans, Muslims from all over the world, we are ready to lead. So don't expect for us with leadership mantle wrapped around our shoulders to come half-stepping and mealy-mouthed. Now, there was so much decadence in Detroit, Michigan, that they rejected their most important native son in the history of the state of Michigan. Not just Detroit, but the state of Michigan. Imam Wahdatuddin Muhammad was from Detroit. And he was blessed to develop into a global spiritual leader, acknowledged by the late Pope John Paul II. If the late Pope John Paul II could see from afar the outstanding leadership of Imam Muhammad, you going to tell me that the people in Detroit, Michigan, where Farad Muhammad and his father, the late Honorable Elijah Muhammad, started the Nation of Islam, where this man was born, they couldn't see it? Yes, they could see it, but they rejected the values that he brought. They had gotten caught up in a fiery, desert-like lifestyle. And when he came to challenge that lifestyle, they rejected, not him as a person, but they rejected the life-saving mindset that he brought. And I got a magazine upstairs with the front there, Why Everybody Hate Detroit. Now, he was not born in Chicago, Illinois, but he spent most of his life there. Everybody in Chicago knew about the Nation of Islam and the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He met with all the leadership, the prelates and the politicals. And he brought solutions as a expert fireman before the blaze of incineration, mass incineration, got out of control. Just like a master fireman in the woods, he built a trench around the blaze to contain it. And what did the narrow-minded, selfish African-American leadership, and I know the folk not going to want to hear this, from Jesse on around, what did they do? They went and got shovels and covered up the ditch, hoping that people wouldn't see the excellent leadership out of undue leadership competition, jealousy, and envy. Well, how can you say that? Well, when the first president of African American was elected, they caught Jesse on a hot wire, saying that he, in essence, wanted to denut the brother. I'm just paraphrasing his language. So we shouldn't be shocked if he's ultra-competitive with African-American leadership. Dr. King had to tell him, look, if you want to make a name for yourself, then don't do it on me. And he stormed away from him. So we see at a moment when we could have gotten a grip on the incineration prior to the mass incarceration, where the secular and sacred leadership conspired to sabotage the leadership of Imam Muhammad. What do I say? There are consequences throughout history when a people consciously, coldly, arrogantly, and contemptuously reject sound, sober advice, especially if it comes from the plane of the prophets. Now, Imam Muhammad was not a prophet. In our religion, Prophet Muhammad was the seal of the prophet. Imam Muhammad was the mujaddid, the one who came, and not just any local parochial mujaddid. He was one who came as a global mujaddid. After our religion collapsed completely in the dark, as the seer predicted, one day darkness would come on upon my community, not just in one part of the world, but the global Islamic community. So this religious reformer came out of love to his people with sound advice as to how to put out the fire. And we rejected it. So now you have a mass runaway destructive fire, even to the extent that the instrument of murder is called firepower, killing up each other in unprecedented numbers. But it's not just Chicago. This fire is uncontained all around the country in the black community. And let me say to you, Cain-like rationalizers who want to avoid our responsibility to abrogate the collective guilt and project everything on white folk, laws pertaining to mass incarceration. No, we can't get away with that. We refuse to be our brother's keeper in the African-American community, and we sit back and a Nero state, Brother Imam, and we play games and we fiddle while the grassroots African-American community was consumed by runaway, fiery appetites and violence. So now, what am I saying? You're looking at the consequences of rejection, because we have a chance to challenge the blight. We had a chance to patrol the blight. We had a chance to arrest the blight. But because of petty envy and jealousy, we could not come together. And now the roof have caved in. The leadership have collapsed. If there's any secular prelate type instruction, it's coming from a Caucasian priest who seem to be more concerned genuinely about what's happening in Chicago than many of the other ministerial voices. Now, what are we going to have to do? We're going to have to be big enough to acknowledge our failure. Then we're going to have to repent and correct the failure and understand now that only a mass resurrection can save us, a mass resurrection phoenix-like from the ashes of collective mass incineration. We must, Brother Imam, save ourselves and our families, and our combination of families, and our community from a mighty fire. That's our obligation, that's our responsibility. Now, I don't ask everybody to agree with that, but we'll accept all challenges, all comers. Let's debate this question when the sun is high. By that meaning, where when the logic reaches its zenith, We're not interested in a emotional, sentimental debate, fussing and fighting going on. We're interested in a sober debate rooted in high logic. And we have to be respectful and give these apologists a chance to defend their theory. And let them throw first. Let them get their ideas. I throw first about this problematic theory of mass incarceration as the new Jim Crowism. And we'll sit back and calmly, and we're playing out the reality. No, the problem was that which came before the incarceration, this mass incineration. And we'll make a logical, scientific presentation based upon data and everything else to substantiate our position. So don't tell me about Detroit and Chicago. They're under divine punishment. And we have to acknowledge that. So did that answer your question, Brother Imam?
Yes. There's an old Nation of Islam lesson that says, what is the duty of the civilized? Answer, to teach civilization to the uncivilized. And what if they fail to do that? A severe chastisement. And any time you pick up the newspaper and find out right that the mother of civilization, the women that's supposed to be responsible for society and raising the children, the womb of mine, and yet on a New York City subway, not far from Masjid Moshe Khalifa, not far from Masjid Taqwa, headed by Imam Sirat Wahad, and Brother Imam Abid Adib, two African-American young women, one dressed as though she was a man, beat a 78-year-old woman almost to death. And you don't tell me that's a severe chastisement. I have urged the men and women, particularly the men in the Brooklyn Muslim community, to get their Christian friends and posters of these two young ladies and demand that they be brought to justice. God said, let that rise up out of your community, forbidding the wrong. Now, we can talk about George Zimmerman, and we should talk about him. We can talk about the murderer of all these other African women, but what about this brutal woman? Women, women should be mothers, beating a 7-8-year-old lady down like she was an errant dog that attacked them.
Brother, man.
And I haven't heard Michael Eric Dyson. I haven't heard Reverend Alfred C. Shopton. I haven't heard Cornel West. I haven't heard anybody speak out about it. And we wonder why people look at us. Now, that's a chastisement to me. That's a punishment for me to have to look at that. To turn on the television. Yeah.
Brother, ma'am, listen. We follow the just. And we are instructed to take a stand on justice, even if it's against your own selves. That's against your individual self and your collective self. Now, I'm taking a stand on justice against what I think Mr. Trump is perpetuating in our culture and our civilization. But I'm also taking a stand on justice against our own selves. Now, we can criticize other folk, but then you get this old evasive idea not to do justice in terms of a self-critique that's constructive. Don't air our dirty laundry in public. Got mad with President Obama because he tried to bring the counter-critique, the trenchant critique in a constructive way that everybody know. Malcolm brought, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad brought, said that we are foolish people.
We all know this. And even Dr. King brought a constructive critique. And the imam brought a critique for over 30 plus years, doing justice to ourselves. How can we challenge the problem if we don't acknowledge the problem? How can we solve the problem if we don't acknowledge it, critique it, and come up with viable solutions? Got mad because went up and dug up something that a political candidate said about super predators. Well, you tell me what those young people were that vamped savagely on this eight decade African American woman who had to survive all the difficulty and hardship that many of us experience during a life cycle. That she come to her golden age where she had to be strong to be around for almost 80 years. And what's her plight? What's her destiny? Some super predator who looked like her, whip her, worse than a slave master would have. The slave master would not have whipped a 78-year-old African-American female slave. And this is important that this subject is coming out during the week of Roots. And it's re-airing. The slave master would not have whipped a 78-year-old African-American female slave like a dog, apparently, the way you suggested. So, yes, I'm going to acknowledge there are super predators in our community, and we need to deal with them like super predators. We have to understand that when people that acting worse than animals, when wild beasts are let loose in human habitation, you must get out your knife, in this case your sword, the sacred word, and say Bismillah, and take care of business. I'm not making these statements, brother, based upon some kind of little subjective feeling. This is Bismillah. In the name of God, we wage struggle against this kind of foolishness. We must challenge these runaway predatory instincts among our young people. Mama's saying to me,
connections
to Long, what are we going to do about our boys getting killed?
Yes, sir.
I said we need to bring Mama back. That's what I told them. And they went to talk about where we going to go get a T-shirt and print, bring Mama back. The boys of mother. The boys of paradise. Huh?
That's right.
That old-fashioned Mama. That breeder of civilization, Mama. That leader.
That Mama that would meet you in the schoolyard and give you a good whoop and say, I got a blueberry pie for you, son, but I got this Oakley stick for you, too, because you disrespected Miss Jones at school today. And
bring Mama back.
Your home and they throw that sweet potato pie in your face.
That's right, brother, man. Bring Mama back. And they getting ready to get organized, trying to go back and reconnect with the motherhood of Fannie Lou Hamer, or Annie Cooper, or Harriet Tubman, or Sojourner Truth, and many known and unknown. Let's bring Mama back.
And while we at it, while we talk about while we get Mama back, you've been a defense attorney, and I'm sure you've had Mama to come in your office with a pocket book full of money, wanting to get her little Johnny out and maybe her little Raheem out. And she has said to you, do everything you can, and little Rodney or Rodney might have been the guilty of sin. But what's wrong with that picture that Mama doesn't want to see that the son carries weapons, he's violent, he is a predator, but she's getting ready to go down to the prison every week and give him a meal send them some money, and not my little Johnny, not my little Ronnie, not my little Rodney. What's wrong with the picture of our mothers who no longer threw the mama away, and now she all caught up in trying to be a defender of the wrong of her son or daughter? Because now we got women in these same situations, these two girls beat down. I'm not going to talk about that sexuality. One of them even had her pants sagging like she was a man. And
Mama used to say, boy, you made your bed, lie in it. Now, I'm telling you, these murders are so constant in Selma now. And these people, I'm in semi-legal retirement, but they running, coming up to Selma. One case that came to me, I didn't know the victim, and the uncle was a good friend of mine, but very supportive of Islamic activity. The uncle of the alleged murderer, he came to me. I said, okay, I'm thinking about handling the case. A Muslim brother was sitting there who assists me as a paralegal, and he told me, you don't know who that boy was who got killed? I said, no, I didn't. He said, that's blank, blank son. I said, no, this lady worked with me. I even represented her. This is a conflict of interest. So I got with the friend, the uncle. I told him, look, I can't do it. Then here come a situation. I go to a court, and some young brothers ride up and park next to each other at a red light, and they start blasting. One guy is critically injured. The judge said, take one of these cases, Salam, attempted murder. Take one of these cases, attempted murder. Now, I've always had a policy. I'm not handling any capital murder cases. I don't do that. I might handle a murder every now and then. But this was attempted murder. So now, that's okay, Your Honor. I'll take the case. I got in there. There's two things about this case. I'm at another bond here. I'm about to get these brothers released. Then some woman come up as a witness for the other side. And she tells the judge that she got an image. Now, this doesn't prove that my clients are guilty. But it does put a bad taste in the judge's mouth in terms of him making a fair decision on bond. He said, look, she said, look, here these two guys are. They're on Facebook. The next day, patting their guns and giving all kind of signs. When the judge heard that, that was it. Even though the evidence was not authenticated, we couldn't even didn't even get a chance to challenge whether or not it was an authentic piece of evidence. A week later, I get a call to come to court. The victim dies, and now they're charging all these boys with capital murder. Now, I'm in a dilemma. I resent this violence, this mass incineration in our community. These guys are presumed to be innocent until proven guilty. But some telling me now, don't take another case. Don't you take another case, especially after that boy came back to Selma sitting in a car and got his brain blew out. I go to a bond hearing, and then there's two or three other cases of murder sitting out there. They see me argue the bond, reduction of bond, and when I leave in court, they running up behind me, will you take my son's case?
Oh, God.
I don't know whether I want to take your son's case. And if I take your son's case, you can't afford to pay me what
a lawyer should get for this kind of defense. And I've taken these cases, I haven't hit them hard. Get these Caucasian attorneys out of Montgomery and what have you. Some of them, they take a big fee and then plead a guy out, try to avoid him from getting a death penalty or something like that. This is Salem, Alabama. I'm in sitting down eating lunch yesterday, and two sisters in that party, oh, they just talking and gossiping about, hey, I might have to leave this town. There's too much killing going on. Yeah, we have a problem in Chicago and Detroit and other metropolitan areas, but this massive pie is now hitting home in what you call the bastion of civil rights success and achievement. And we must take a stand against it. Now, I didn't mean to say all this, but you see, a man that's on the front line is an attorney. And now they're coming to me, Salon, we remember 10 years ago when you organized 100 black men and men and women, and this boy got killed at the shopping center, and you all went out there Friday night, and you patrolled the area, and the young folk looked at all of you dressed in black, and they left and never did show up again at this site. I say, yeah, all that was true. But when I'm looking at these young brothers now, I see cold-blooded murder in their eyes. And even a tactic or a strategy like that, it may not be successful. And I'm hesitant to go back. Yeah, we can organize these folk, but some of these young predators, brother, may ride by in a car and arbitrarily and capriciously shoot down a concerned citizen. So we did that nonviolently. I would hate to see us have to take security in arms to implement a strategy like that. That's where we are in Selma, Alabama.
This is the citadel of the freedom movement. This is where the Pedder Street Bridge is, and yet it has become a killing field. What does say about African America?
Yes, sir, that's a fact. I saw a Caucasian coming from Montgomery. I was coming to Montgomery. We stopped at a service station. She used to be one of my office assistants when I was in the state house. She looked at me and she said, Salam, everybody in the state house saying that Selma is gone. I said, yeah, you saw what happened. She saw what happened politically to get us in this state. And then she looked at me, this Caucasian now. Don't feel bad, Salam. You tried to help us. You tried to get out there and help solve the problem. And if she feels that it's gone, I know how the rest of them feel. And it's not going to be long before they start abandoning Selma in a big way. We don't have the property base, if they do, to run the city, and that's going to perpetuate more chaos. So we got to get a grip on this thing before we're in a fatal, irreversible situation in historic Selma, Alabama. That's Selma. But that's mild compared to the slaughter that's going on in Chicago.
But in proportion, it's pretty much the same. Where we see African Americans in large numbers, Southern or Northern, we have seen a killing field. So, does this fuel the rise of the Donald Trump-like forces, white supremacists, or even people may not be white supremacists,
by people who've just been negatively influenced by our kind of shameful behavior. Would you speak to that?
Well, certainly. There are people who look at our behavior and, in a sense, try to justify their racial animus. And I can understand that the behavior is shameful. But I've been out there in the political world. If a person uses political scientific strategy to say that I cannot win with my strategy unless I get 62% of the Caucasian vote. Now, in the last 50 years, Mitt Romney took it to the outer limits, 59%. And you saw what happened to him with Obama. Now, if a candidate, his sole strategy is on galvanizing as many white voters as he can, feeding them red meat, I don't care whether people got the nerve to call. Why you want to go and vote for a man who all he's doing is trying to galvanize the white vote? You can say you're not racist if you want to, but you lumped into that mass where a man is making an explicit racial appeal as a matter of demographics to become president of these United States. That's what we see happening. For those of us who don't study politics, we don't understand that. That's why he could get on television and call a sitting federal judge, a man who potentially has to respect separation of powers in our government. The president can't dictate to a judge, call this man a Mexican, ginning up his base trying to get to that 62%. Because he's given up on African Americans and he's given up on Latinos. But people don't understand. If he can beat Romney's number by 3%, according to the political scientists, he may can win. But what kind of country will we have if you got a man that became president and the votes he got was primarily all white? And then you have this budding brown and demographic over here that's eventually going to become the majority. Already all the children up under five that are not white are in the majority now. In 46 states, the children under 18, the majority is non-white. So, yeah, we present a bad image. And our African brothers are ashamed of it. The Eastern Muslim brother try to critique that. The Asian people around the world, they look at that and they wonder whether or not we belong in what they call civilized society. Even though we can look at some of their cultures and see a lack of civilization. But Brother Ibrahim, I cannot let these Caucasian people off the hook when their only reason for voting for a man evidently is that he calling all white folks together. So that's something bigger.
I can't let them off the hook. And I can't let them off the hook really when we look at Roots. Not that I watched it, but I do think that we have to understand that 80% of what's going on in Selma, 80% what's going on in Chicago, 80% what's going on in urban America, even 80% of what went on in the minds of those African-American young women that beat that African-American woman near to death has something to do with the connection of that 400-year experience we have and a moral relapse that we have suffered. Because the elements in the society is not allowed the medical treatment of the spirit and mind and the soul of African Americans as given by Imam Muhammad and even Dr. King. These men have been blurted out. Instead, we've been given Snoop Doggy Dogg. Now, Snoop, he's against the showing of roots. I don't know why. There are others. But I think that we really do have to say that 80%, and I'm paraphrasing Imam Muhammad, when we have broken families, but mama doesn't respect daddy, where daddy doesn't respect mama, where children don't respect parents, where the authority of parents is basically minimized, and men have been pushed out of the home, and then men have not known how to band together and create jobs and economy for themselves, I'm not going to let white America off the hook. Imam Muhammad said he came with two whips. So I got another whip, too. I come with both whips. I understand the societal problem. I don't even, to use the old postmodern theory, that's white privileges. I think this issue, even of the drug addiction, suddenly now America's grappling with it. America didn't say very much when drugs was in East Selma. Didn't say much when it was in Harlem. Didn't say much when it was in Bed-Stuy. Didn't say much when it was the north side of Buffalo. But now that it's appearing in our neighborhoods, they're being disturbed, and police officers are carrying anti-convulsive drugs with them. So I understand that. I understand that. My only concern is to form judgment on my own people, and I don't let the other America off hook because I think that there are a lot of dark days in store for America. And I'm not for some massive welfare program to ameliorate this. I think the first thing we need is a program to bring our souls back right with God and come back to mama.
Well, look, buddy, ma'am, this is my personal feelings on this thing. To each is a goal. Every race has a destiny. Now, in my opinion, the Caucasian, you are American as a general rule, is on the brink of severe societal decadence. Everybody has their destiny. Now, once upon a time, the Native Americans ruled in this land. Once upon a time, in Alabama, the Spanish ruled, and to a certain extent before the Louisiana Purchase, the French rule. Now, no particular group has to be on this land to rule, including Anglo-Saxon Protestant America. Now, this is my personal opinion. I went through the hell of slavery with my Caucasian brother, coerced and have any option. I'm a Southern boy. I went through Jim Crowism. My collective family. Went through that hell. Now, if these people are deliberately inclined toward destruction and hell, popping pills, killing themselves, determined to go to hell. This is where I get off the boat. I'm for a unified America. This is where we're supposed to operate based upon our universal inclination and our deen. But we have a history and an experience, and we don't owe the Caucasians the loyalty that if they go into hell, we're going to go right along with them. We have an obligation. We have a responsibility to gird up our loins and chart our own destiny as a people. We don't know who's going to rule in this land 50 years from now. Maybe the Native American will come back. We don't know. So now look, See, ma'am came with the cosmic, so I'm going to just be up front. Yes, there's a lot of post-traumatic stress from slavery, a good deal of it. And when a people get that kind of internalized post-traumatic stress, generated self-hatred, self-destruction, and wanton violence is bound to ensue. It's only one thing. No economic policy, no political policy alone, no educational strategy, no institutional religious plan, faith-based, can turn it around. When a people get on the brink of the pit of the fire, Brother Imam, and they stop having affection for each other, and they stop having compassion for each other, then you're dealing with a situation where only divine intervention can resolve that. The Creator gonna have to step in and put affection between our hearts. I know some of your audience may not want to hear that. It may sound overly spiritual. Well, let's try a little secular plans then and see, can we get into the condition of the African-American heart and change that state where we are overcome with self-hatred? See, can we do it on the brink of the pit of the fire without the help of our Lord and Creator?
Yes, sir. Well, I think that's a great, great, great answer. What do you say to the public, particularly our Muslim American public? What would you say to them in our closing 3 minutes?
I say to the Muslim American public, shame, shame, shame. I see what you're doing. You're running the boat now, and you're supposed to fear none but Allah. But in your shaky faith, you have allowed Donald Trump to scare you. You're not trying to participate in American order now because you're standing upon Quran and its instructions as to how to operate as a minority in a culture. You doing it out of fear. But I remember back in the 90s when Imam Muhammad started the Coalition for Government. I spoke to many forums as the first Alabama Muslim council person all around the country. You act like you didn't have an ear. You didn't want to hear the Imam when he showed you the parallel between some of the fundamental bedrock American principles in the universal cosmic Quranic guidance. You ignored him. You even, some of you said that participating in the political system was bid-up, that the man was preaching innovation. And now after all these years, you running in a panic talking about voting. That's good. But how are you going to cast your vote? What kind of systematic strategy you going to use to advance your collective interests? Are you going to continue to ignore your brother that's been dealing with political struggle in this country for decades and even centuries and try to run out there and blindly vote? Are you going to humble yourselves and do today what you refused to do when Imam Muhammad was alive and listen to his sober guidance of the need to organize ourselves to protect our interests within the context of this republic and American democratic order. I say shame, 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 Brother Imam.
You're saying that the Muslim African American has abdicated his responsibility.
No, no, I'm talking about primarily with that critique, they showing that the brothers from other parts of the world are registering to vote in large numbers now. That's a fact. But
well, what about
the mayor went to Israel and all other kind of conventions trying to show them the need to protect themselves by organizing.
I wasn't speaking of him. I'm going to repeat what Imam Muhammad said about him. Imam said the Muslim immigrant has been a snake in the garden, and I haven't found anything to contradict that. I've worked with them, and I'm convinced more than ever that they're here to undermine our work. I was thinking of the Muslim African Americans. That's what I'm thinking of.
Well, let's look at the question from that frame of reference.
I misunderstood you. So now, what's the question in the context of African
Americans? What would you say to the Muslim African American in light of one of the leading Muslim African Americans, politicians called for us to create a PAC? I've seen very little activities on the part of the Muslim African Americans, the 2.5 million of Imam Muhammad followers. I see that they still haven't organized in any kind of political manner.
Let me say this.
I just want you to make a comment on that. I get the immigrant Muslim. I know what he's
That was a very, very wise and shrewd suggestion of this brother. He's been in the game and he's learning the game. We should have listened to him yesterday and forthrightly without hesitation, without a whole lot of analysis that end up in paralysis. We should move on that. There should be a pact of that nature. In time, out of that pact, we will get the strength to make a pact with the general government order that we ready to take our place. And in this pact, don't slow us down or try to stop us. Out of this pact gonna come a president that's Muslim. Out of this pact is gonna come local and state officials all around the country. Out of this pack in time is going to come congressional leaders and the brother who made it. And I hope you don't mind me calling his name.
No, sir, please do.
Representative Andre Carson. Already he's on a short list as one of the potential leaders to come from minority status and to match Obama by becoming the president of these United States, President Barack Hussein Obama. So that was a very good idea. I'm hoping that somehow we can get with our good brother, sincere, decent human being, and try to discuss the logistics of such a move. What it's going to take, what are we going to have to do? And move with strong resolution to make it happen. What are we sitting back for?
I thank you, my dear brother and friend. And we will continue this next week. Religion means a lot. It didn't look like it was an hour, but we went an hour and 4 minutes. And I thank you so much. I hope you'll be back
next
week.
Brother, ma'am, you got a knack of bringing the information out. You got a knack of laying the questions out in a manner where we have to put it where the goats can get to us.
Well, I thank you.
That's old Southern
these things were the
question
of our conscience. We didn't intend for this, but when I read the newspaper this morning and saw the news, I was just compelled to ask these questions. I'm very disturbed. I had another question to ask, but I'm going to leave it. And I'm going to say, I hope you'll be on tomorrow, on Sunday, to make comments for our first Sunday. But until tomorrow, I'm going to be interviewed tomorrow myself, and you all can call in tomorrow at 805-727-7013. I believe one of the interviews would be Alfred Y. Muhammad, future student at Morehouse College, the college that was made renowned by the studentship of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., headed by the great Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, and one of its most illustrious students was Dr. Howard K. Thurman. Now, I'm looking forward to my son attending the bastion of African-American educational life at Morehouse. Thank you. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You have listened once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive.
Peace be upon you. Assalamu alaikum.
Walaikum assalam. I'm going to cook.